Monday, December 16th, was a nightmare of a day in the White House, with the dark black coils of the nightmare twisting underneath the surface of a day that was jam-packed full with calls, appointments, house guests, engagements. I had an early breakfast with Lyndon and worked at the desk with Marilyn and then with Bess on the Christmas parties, one every day this week, and then a host of calls about Tony to Diana and Matiana, and to Dr. Voss, who will see him today, and we'll get him in the hospital tomorrow morning for a thorough test. Tony is the main part of the nightmare, his dragging right leg and his speech that halts in mid-sentence because he forgets, and the all-too-frequent laugh. And the horror of it is that he knows that something fearful is happening to him. He told Matiana that he laughs because he doesn't know what else to do. It's sort of a social crutch, I guess. But we are full of resolution to attack this thing head on and to find out what it is, to use every intelligence and facility at our command to combat it. And I called Clark Clifford and Carol Fortas, two of my chief advisors, and made dates to see them, and Barefoot Sanders, who is suggesting that we have a reception for the Congress right after January the 3rd. I recommended against it, and so did Bess. More work with Marilyn and Liz, and finally a break, go up to the solarium and have lunch with my house guests. A week or two ago, I had invited Belle Patilla Tippett, my Selma, Alabama cousin, to come up with her husband and spend a few days sightseeing and family visiting, explaining carefully to her that I would have a heavy work schedule, but in between her sightseeing, we could have time for lunch or maybe sit by the fire and drink and talk about Uncle Claude and Aunt Effie and wading in the streams at Billingsley. I did not dream that their arrival here would be in quite such a time of tension and trouble. But at any rate, lunch up in the solarium, that hospitable room that has housed so much of our family life, was a pleasant time. Eloise Thornberry, pretty and gay, on her way to a committee meeting about deaf people, was a great help. And dear Matiana, unobtrusively helping Tony around. And we did talk about old times, Belle and Tony and I, as we looked out at the Washington Monument and remembered summers in Alabama and cousins and that great old white columned house. But it was brief for me, and then I went down to the Lincoln sitting room to record for the ABC show. Simone rides herd on it. How I shall miss her. It's the very end of this week that she will go. It went rather smoothly. I tried to immerse myself in the feel of the show, of the house, of my deep regard for it. And then, at last, a bonus. The no-think time, the going to the beauty parlor. A marvelous release from effort. At least no-think for a part of it, although I carried the usual straw bag for work under the dryer. That being mostly going over the list of the press ladies who would arrive for the party at 6 o'clock. And then back to the White House and an hour's work with Lynn. And then into Lyndon's room where he had been trying to get a nap. It was obvious that his cold had worsened. He's had a dragging cold for ages, weeks it seems. He looked up at me and said, I don't believe I can make it. He really looked bad. I said, you ought not to go out there in that cold. You ought to have gotten the vice president to do this, knowing that it was now too late. We were due there in moments. I felt angry with myself that I hadn't taken charge of this sooner, but I cooperated, even shoved, in getting him to do something I knew he ought not to do, simply because there was a crowd waiting and TV lights set up, and he was expected. When we walked out about 5:30, Lyndon and Lucy and Lynn and I in the big back car and drove to the Ellipse to light the Christmas tree for the sixth and final time. Jim Udall presided at the ceremony, and it was bitter cold up on the platform. As we mounted the steps, someone had tried to hand Lyndon his hat. He had brushed it aside, and there he was, hatless, though several of the men had very sensibly held on to their hats. It was a brief, stirring, dear ceremony. Christmas carols by a robed choir, a brief presentation of red roses to me by a Girl Scout, a short patriotic speech by a Boy Scout. Lyndon always rises and congratulates both of them, and so do I, and they've never failed to be really good. Some words of welcome by the mayor, and the wind was so fierce it was practically lifting our hair right off of our scalps. And then Lyndon's talk. My prayer now, as it has been in each of these other Decembers, is for peace and reconciliation abroad, justice and tranquility at home. And finally, the pressing of the button that lit the 74-foot spruce tree into its glory of blue and white and yellow lights, and the 50 trees of the states that grouped around it on their lips. And it was a glorious sight. We were all caught up in the feeling that this was indeed the last time for us. But I'm getting a little impatient now of last times, and just as ready to get on with whatever comes after. The Marine Band struck up the national anthem, and we all pulled up an extra 2 inches taller. And of course, the ham, the delight of the evening, was, as usual, Lynn, also the most sensibly dressed man present, in matching leather coat and cap with the flaps that came snugly over his ears, all big-eyed and delighted at the Christmas tree, waving to the crowd from his granddaddy's arms, and then reaching over to Walter Washington's cute little granddaughter to give her a kiss. And then, very quickly, we were back in the car. Scarcely more than 30 minutes had elapsed before we returned, thoroughly chilled, to the White House. I do not remember just at what moment it was the second chapter of the nightmare unfolded. Someone of my staff, it may have been Sharon or Marcia, told me that Liz had been called shortly before and asked to rush to the hospital and bring someone with her. Les had been choking. They had given him an emergency tracheotomy in his own hospital bed without even taking him to the operating room. Dear Simone had been with her. She is a good friend to all of us. And so this, then, was the setting for my last party for the press ladies, much planned and much looked forward to. They were invited up to the second floor, and I greeted them just inside the door of the yellow room. No announcer necessary here, since I knew every one of them, from river rafts and forest trails and art galleries and White House parties. A fire burned merrily in the yellow room, and there were Christmas decorations everywhere, a bar set up out in the hall. A small group of the Marine bands in their red coats playing Christmas music down toward the east end of the hall. And the family sitting room opened up invitingly, and a delicious buffet spread in the family dining room. There were the regulars, Isabel Shelton and Dorothy McCardle and Helen Thomas, without Francis Lewin, who is on vacation, and old-timers Esthamay Tufte and Isabel Griffin, who goes back with me to about 1938, I think, and Hope Ridings Miller and Josephine Ripley, and pert little Bonnie Angelo and Norma Milligan, wearing an LBJ pin, I think in spite of anything that Newsweek has said about us. But she has always had a certain sympathy and understanding for us. And Texans Margaret Meyer, whom perhaps I've known the longest of all, and Sarah McClendon, thorn in the flesh for all press secretaries, but nice enough to me, and Karen Kleinfelter. And I think Wahilla LaHaye, who perhaps felt more sentimental about this evening than anybody, although the whole evening had a certain sadness right below the laughter and merriment, and everybody was saying, oh, we're going to miss you so. It'll be a hard act to follow. And there was Chris Sadler, Linda Bird's boss and friend, and Nan Robertson, who writes very high-class stories, I think, and Linnell Aikman, who's worked with me on the White House books, the National Geographic, and Betty Beale, one of my favorites, who was admiring the Glackens and telling me, and how right she is, that I should have tried harder long ago to get publicity about every gift that came to the White House. And she said that she, through a column, had brought about the gift of the Indian paintings that hang in the library, and Nancy Dickerson, looking terrifically smart, and Julie Moon, and Naomi Nova, and Faye Ritter, and Sissy Marcy. The name of everyone brings up memories. I doubt if there's a group that I know better here in Washington than these press women, and I've really enjoyed them. The news of Les's condition had carefully been kept quiet by me and my staff, but Liz's absence meant to them that he was not doing well. Wild horses could not have kept Liz from this party, if he'd been all right. And so, on the surface, I laughed and joked and talked and really enjoyed them. And underneath, there was a chill level of tension about Tony and about Les. As they left, about 7:30, I told them to be sure and pick up their Christmas gift at the east end of the hall. Liz's office, with much imagination and hard work, had put together a montage of pictures of all of our trips over the 5 years. These were wrapped around a wastebasket, laminated onto it by some process, and I, at least, was crazy about them. Quite a few of the ladies had told me during the evening that the small Christmas tree I had given them a year or two ago was actually growing in their backyard. We'll have a lot to remember each other by. When the last one was gone, I went and called Liz. Her voice was full of tears, but controlled. She said Les was in the intensive care ward, but she believed the danger was past. And the awful part was that they couldn't really figure out why all of it was happening. I went down to the theater to say hello to all my house guests who were watching a movie, grateful that we had this to offer them, since my time was so fragmented. And then back, exhausted, to the second floor, called Chief Dunn and got a rub while I made a series of calls, Marcia and Sharon, Simone and Diana, about the next day's business and troubles. I thought with wry amusement of something that Lyndon had said this morning. It went about like this. I told the Dallas News that there are 10 sons of bitches in the United States, the 2 news magazines and the 2 news services, and the New York Times, and here I lost count. And he went on to say, it satisfied me, it cleansed my soul, but I will never recover from it. He had gone on reminiscing about Strom Thurmond and said, he has stuck the knife in me, deep in my heart, but I think he has done it courteously and honestly. I think he has a certain liking for me. He is just true to his convictions. I, too, believe that is a fair evaluation, and he's easier to take than some of our Democrats.